I'm Ken Hemmings, and he is Chris Lang, and welcome to another of these regular property briefings. Again, a warm welcome to you, Chris.
Well, it's good to be back with you again.
As you know, we've tended to follow a particular theme in previous podcasts. However, today I actually have several questions ranging over a number of topics, if that's okay with you.
Yeah, that's fine with me.
In your 9-step investment formula, one way or another, the aspect of finance seems to play a major part. So I was wondering if you might walk us through how and why that's the case.
It's interesting you bring that up because you're right. Finance is important. It is a major part. And that's why effectively I've devoted 2 steps in the 9-step process to the issue of finance. And while most people only focus on obtaining the money after they've made the purchase, you also need to protect yourself, and that's that step 3, which is being able to sleep at night, by knowing that you have not paid too much for the property. Now, a lot of my clients come and say, look, I have to buy the property subject to finance. And as I say to them, that's not actually correct. And in the current market particularly, vendors are not really going to be interested in talking to you if you want to have a condition of the contract that it is subject to you obtaining your finance, because they've got enough other buyers out there that are hungry for the property that won't require that condition. So what you really need to do is to buy the property subject to knowing a figure up to which a valuer will support. Now, I guess I have the advantage because I've been doing this for a while, and also I deal with a number of clients that I can and have set up an arrangement with a valuer who will provide me in advance of the purchase an indication as to the figure up to which they will support. In other words, they're saying, that's the maximum you can go to. And so I can convey that to my clients. Now, they may choose to go higher than that figure, and there may be reasons for doing that. It might be it's a particular property they want for their business or whatever the reason. However, what the valuer is telling me, that's the figure up to which they'll support. If they pay more, they may not support it, in which case you would have to chip in a bit more equity. But so long as you don't exceed that figure, when the time comes for the valuation, they'll support that. Now, if you buy the property for less than that figure, they will only value it at its highest at the contract price. Even though they would have supported a higher figure, they'll only value it for lending purposes at the contract price. But that then tells you, let's say if you bought it at 90% of what they were prepared to support, that tells you you've already got a 10% growth built in because they would have supported a higher figure in the current market. So, I mean, that's a plus, and quite often that's what we're able to do. But the important thing is that you know at the time of signing the contract that you're not going to have a surprise of the bank coming back and saying, terribly sorry, we know you paid such and such a price, but our valuer won't value it at that figure. It is a lesser figure, because quite often in giving instructions to the valuer, they will ask them to be conservative, mainly because they're under instructions from head office that they only want to lend money that's absolutely belt and braces, 100% secure. And the way they do that is that they, by having a lesser valuation, they keep the same loan-to-value ratio, but they're effectively lending less of the true value of the property, which, if we've done everything right, will be the contract price. So it's important that you understand that. Now, the second part is in step 6, where, unlike the traditional approach where, yes, you might talk to a financier and get an indicative understanding of what they will lend, you then go cap in hand to that lender and say, well, here's the contract, now let's do the deal. Now, historically, what then happens is that the bank goes off, gets the valuation, as I said, may not control it. But the problem is that they have a panel of valuers. Now, we know that the valuer that I deal with will be on that panel, but if they have eight other valuers, he's got a 1 in 9 chance, or she's got a 1 in 9 chance of being appointed. So what we then do is to have our valuer do a valuation for my client, and they provide it to them as a soft copy, as a PDF copy. Now, again, I counsel my clients not to deal directly with the financier, but rather go through the finance broker that I've used for a long time now, and not only my clients, my family use the same broker, because he is able to get within 48 hours, knowing your financial background, a firm indication of the commercial terms of what your loan arrangements will be. Now, we then provide the soft copy of the valuation to him, and he might have spoken to two or three and got a couple of alternatives, but not yet decided which is the one that he would recommend running with. He supplies the valuation to each of them, and without saying so, the unspoken implication is, look, we now need you to firm up on your commercial terms. Don't be cute about it, because we've obviously handed this round to other parties. Because at that point, the valuation is owned and controlled by you as the purchaser, because you have instructed the valuer to carry it out, and you will be the one paying the fee. It doesn't matter where it comes in, you'll be paying the fee, either whether it's directly to the valuer or through the bank, who then pay it to the valuer. Now, in the past, you might say, well, I don't remember paying a valuer. Well, you probably didn't. It was just one of the expenses that at settlement got paid out of the funds that the bank lends you. So the important thing is that you have control. As I said, not only then are the indicative commercial terms that have been provided to the finance broker confirmed, but also the legal or contractual terms of the loan are provided. Now, they can't afford, as lenders, to come up with any last-minute quirky changes to the normal legal terminology and loan contract terms, because still at that point they don't have the value or control of the valuation, because it's still in your name. So it might be right to the last minute that you hold off making the decision on which of the financiers, because while one might have good commercial terms, it might have unnecessarily strict contract terms. Like they might say, well, we also want to lean over your business or whatever it is. Now, if they'd organised the valuation, you got nowhere to go. But because you had the valuation, you can just blithely say, sorry, not interested. And you've then got one or two others that you can go to. And so only when you and the finance broker have narrowed it down to the best commercial terms and the best legal terms of the contract, do you then instruct the valuer to assign the valuation across to the lender. Now, the finance broker I use, Perry Finance, he knows all the panels that this valuer is on, and they're on 95%. There might be some obscure ones where they're not, but they're on all the major banks, all the major finance houses and what have you. So using them is not an issue. And the beauty is that you control everything through to the end. As I said, you want to sleep at night when you purchase the property, but you also don't want surprises in the process from signing the contract through to settlement. You want all to go smoothly under your control. And the fewer the number of moving parts, the less likely you are to have those surprises. And that's what I've tried to do, is just nail it down. And as I said, finance is 2 out of the 9. nearly 20% or just over 20% of the whole of the nine-step formula, but it's that important. You need to get it right.
Okay. Thanks for clarifying that. Now, do you mind if we just change tack for a moment and take a look at what causes a property value to increase over time?
Well, when we talk about increasing value over time, there are a couple of issues, and they relate to the yield from the property and the rental on the property. When I say yield, that's the cap rate that you buy it at. Now, let's say the lease has built into it automatic annual 3.5% increases in rental. At the end of the first 12 months, let's assume for simplicity you buy it when the day the lease starts. So at the end of 12 months, the rent goes up 3.5%. Now, if the capitalization rate is unchanged, that means the value of your property has now gone up by 3.5% in that 12 months, just by simply the rent increasing. So then you've got to look at the yield. Now, let's say for the purpose of this example, you purchased it on a 7.5% yield. And let's say at the end of the 12-month period, because the market's improved, the yield then is 7.25. So in other words, the yield has fallen by 0.25%. Now, when you combine the increase in rent of 3.5% and the decline in your selling yield of 0.25%, that delivers to you an increase of 7% over the 12 months. So it's double just by the simple reduction of 0.25% in the selling yield what you would have otherwise got simply by the increase in rental. If, because the market's moving pretty quickly, the selling yield in fact drops 0.5% down to 7% as a selling yield. So you've now got a 3.5% increase in rental and a 0.5% drop in your selling yield. That means that you have had the benefit now of an 11% increase over the 12-month period just by combining the increasing rent and the falling yield. And so having the incremental rent increases are important, but equally the adjustment or the decline in the selling yield. So it's a combination of the two, and it's that combination that provides you with capital growth over time. Now, part of what I talk about is super growth as one of the things that you need to look at, and that is how you can inexpensively add value. So instead of just being the rent increasing by 3.5%, if you can change the use partway through and you suddenly get a 10% increase in rent as the lease expires or a change of tenants or even more, that's terrific. But equally, as we talked about in previous podcasts, is creating separate titles where you might have one title and create two. Now, what I generally find is that will automatically shave up to 0.5% or 0.5% off your selling yield. So without the market even moving, just the flexibility of creating two smaller titles than the one larger title makes it a far more attractive and appealing product in the marketplace, because potentially the smaller parcels appeal to a far wider market. So it's that combination of yield and rental that will underpin your increase over time.
You mentioned that one of the factors for growth was selling yields trending downwards. What are some of the underlying reasons why this is likely to happen?
Well, selling yields are a factor of supply and demand. So in other words, if more property isn't coming onto the market, but people are still wanting it, that will cause a clamouring of buyers after the available property. But then if you have an influx of overseas money, that accelerates the demand. So there's no one factor, but it is more money chasing less property, or more money chasing same amount of property. But also, as interest rates fall, the alternatives for return diminish. In other words, you just can't, bank deposits where they used to command 5-7% are now commanding 2-3%. So people are saying, well, instead of having my money tied up in bank deposits or bonds or fixed interest, I really need to go out and take a bit more risk. And okay, I'm now prepared to buy a property. Well, again, that adds to the demand chasing the property. It's not necessarily there's a shortage, a severe shortage of property on the market. There's just 3, 4, 5 times as many people chasing it. So if you get outbid at an auction or at an expression of interest or a private sale negotiation, just because someone else has said, well, okay, ideally I'd like 8%, but I'll take 7.75%. And then the next time around, 7.75%, okay, I'll have to pay, except 7.5%. And then it gets down to 7.25%. So what happens is that people are finding they're just going to have to pay that little bit more and accept a lower yield on the same rental for the property than they might have done 12, 18 months ago. And that's what causes, or the factors behind that growth and that reduction in the selling yield.
Tell me, what's the easiest way for our listeners to keep tabs on these sort of movements within the various commercial sectors?
Well, there's no magic thing here. Look, the newspapers are pretty good. Places like CoreLogic, that's something you have to pay for, but you can subscribe to that. Generally, the reporting of sales is quite good. Some agencies put out reports on different sectors. You can subscribe to those. Again, some of the really in-depth research you might have to pay for, but generally they bring out quarterly reports. The Property Council of Australia bring out reports. They publish a 6-monthly one for offices and commercial sales, or half yearly, generally in January and July for the 6 months prior. Again, I think they might have some more in-depth paid stuff. But look, it's just a matter of keeping tabs. And, if you find a property, doing your research, you find a property, follow it through. If you've been in touch with the agent on the way through, generally they will tell you what it sold for after the marketing's over. So there's no fixed and firm way to do it. So those are a couple of avenues you might look at.
Thanks for filling us in on that. I didn't realise that you could readily gain access to this sort of information. So that no doubt will prove very helpful going forward. Anyway, this format of a mixed bag of questions seemed to work quite well. And so, if you're happy, we might try it again sometime.
Yes, you're right. I thought it certainly added some variety. So let's do that.
Okay, Chris. Until next time, then.